So the label we have here says this is episode 10. It's actually episode 9 of season 12 of Mention and Dispatches. It's not that we're out of order. We just didn't record something last week. So we'll make it up somewhere else down the line. Mike is back. Mike, how are we today?
I'm doing good. And one day we're going to catch those people who didn't do that recording last week, and we're going to have some words with them.
Those rat bastards. Yeah. we'll do something egregious to them. And then first time joining us on Mention and Dispatches, it's taken us over 12 seasons to get around to inviting him, but you know, for him to join us, Mr. Darren Leveloff is here, designer and you know, playtester and honcho of series and whatever else. So Darren, welcome. Glad you're here.
Thank you. Thank you very much for inviting me. I'm glad to be able to join you guys.
And the great thing about you being out on the left coast is, you know, this is still a reasonable hour for you.
So, I just finished work. I'm still in my office.
Yeah, we set some later hours on this because when we started recording podcasts, you know, however many years ago, some of us still had kids that needed bedtimes. So 9 o'clock seemed like a safe enough time that the kids were safely in bed. And we've just sort of stuck with it because it seems to work. Unless we need somebody from Europe on here, then it's a bit of a challenge. So Darren is one of the, I mean, he's the big brain behind the States of Siege series. Definitely want to talk to you about that. I am curious, like the thumbnail sketch of how you ended up as a wargamer.
Yeah. I guess, I know I've listened to some of your shows and I know there's some role play overlap, or at least that history occurs. And so when I was a young man, Dungeons and Dragons was breaking into consciousness, and I became very active in role playing games. And I want to be very careful how I phrase this, but I discovered that a lot of the people I was playing those games with weren't maturing, and I was. We'll leave it at that. And so I go to these game conventions in Los Angeles, and it's interesting because that's going to tie back into this, because those conventions, I don't know if they were specifically run by, but Alan Emmerich was a personage very active in those Los Angeles game conventions when I was a teenager. And I'd go to those game conventions, and I knew I kind of liked history. And I remember 1983 or 1984, somewhere around there, a couple guys playing Victory Games' Civil War. And I said, do you mind if I look at it? You know, and I looked at it, and I watched them for maybe an hour play that game. It's a very long game, and I was fascinated. And I ended up picking up a copy of that. And so the segue kind of went from there. When I went to high school, there was a club, and it's too late to sue them for copyright infringement, but there was a club called Strategy and Tactics Club that was a game club. And I joined it, and there were only like 3 members, and nothing really happened. And there were both basically people who wanted to join the military. You know, there was signups for clubs the next year, 11th grade. And I just said, you know, why don't I start up the Strategy and Tactics Club? And so I became the leader of my high school gaming club for 2 years. And the rest is sort of history.
And so from there grew this fascination with wargaming. And it's interesting because the Victory Games, the Civil War game from Victory, that one still shows up on convention tables today. I mean, it's
a great game. I bought my 5th copy recently because somebody was selling a set that was laminated, and you know, it'll never go away for me. So I used to have it, an extra map pinned up on my wall in college.
Yeah.
So a great game. And you know, that was sort of the transition. And it's kind of weird because I know a lot of, you know, Grognards talk about wargaming, and there's always this the halcyon days of SPI. And I know nothing other than his history about that. That was not my period. SPI was already gone. I had no resentment against TSR when I came into the hobby. So there it is.
Yeah. A lot of that resentment stems from what happened with the magazines, you know, more than anything there. So,
right. Now I was going to ask, did you drift away from RPGs then, or did you ever go back? Are you still doing any RPG stuff?
You know, I drifted completely away until I had kids. And then, you know, they showed some interest. And I thought of, you know, I'd like run a little D&D adventure. So a little bit. And actually, my eldest son now is getting very active in Dungeons and Dragons. And so maybe I'll join him I think my game master days are done, but I could be a character. So, but by and large, no. There's a lot of nostalgia. I have some friends from that era, so we yeah. will joke about, you know, dying instantly in Traveler or something like that.
Oh yeah. Well, you know, you can always like Brett. You can always like Brett and I do. Instead of playing these things, you just buy the rule books and just read them.
Just collect them. Yeah.
Collect them.
I've done that. I have some Champions rule books.
Okay, there you go.
Yeah. Years ago, somebody asked, you know, sort of, how many base game systems do you own? You know, just like the basic rule book, not like all the expansions and modules and, you know, alternate rules and whatever else, just the actual base games. How much of what do you own? And I hit the character count limit on the post. I had to split it across a couple of different posts. You know, I'm not ashamed to say I've acquired several more since then. By several, we're probably talking several dozen since then. And that's just physical copies. That's not PDFs. That's just physical copies. Mike and I are of a similar vein. We spend a lot of time reading these things. We don't spend as much time playing the RPGs. I spend a lot more time playing the board games. But I always enjoy reading a well-written RPG book. So,
fair enough.
Yeah. But I mean, for us growing up, you know, it was all adventure gaming, right? It was all one big hobby. That bifurcation hadn't quite happened yet. I'm sure there's a great ethnographic study about how all that came about at some point. I'm going to let somebody smarter than me do it, though. So Darren, at some point, you had the brilliant idea for, hey, we need some sort of solo tower defense wargaming thing, and I need to come up with a cool way to characterize all it. How did we come up with the States of Siege system? What was the genesis behind this? Where'd the inspiration come from? How'd you convince Alan to publish it? Yada, yada, yada.
Okay. Well, there are two origins. There's sort of like the long-term cause and the proximate cause. So let me go in the long-term cause. You know, getting back sort of to what we were just talking about, you know, although you have me here as a game designer, I consider myself a gamer. I'm a game player. That's really what I am. And it's kind of a lark that I've designed a game or two. You know, for me, you know, the hobby has given a lot to me. I've enjoyed a lot. I have literally thousands of games. I've subscribed to Strategy Tactics Magazine for over 25 years now. You know, we bought a new house and it had a rundown detached office, and that instantly became the War Game Lounge to this day. So, you know, I'd been around the block a lot before and after Strategy, the States of Siege came about. And, you know, when you play these games, you kind of think about what works, what doesn't work, you know, what are neat little things. And then if you ever make the transition to design, you kind of go, hey, I like that. Let's see what I can do with that, And, you know, for whatever reason, this idea, you know, of a solitaire game where things were traversing on a linear front was really prominent in my mind for a while. I think there was an Omega Games game in the 1990s called East Front Solitaire. And you can see a little bit of the origin there, because it had, you were the Germans, you had these linear lines where you're advancing into Russia. You could jump from one line to another, but by and large, it was a linear direction. And, you know, I thought that was a pretty interesting thing, and that came to mind. Additionally, in the time period, I think we're talking early 2000s, when Israeli independence came out, I had started the hobby. There was sort of this, in the mid-80s, this solitaire game board game movement going on. John Butterfield, you had RAF, you had Ambush, Eric Lee Smith, Mosby's Raiders. There was this genre. And that genre kind of went away. I think it was kind of thought, hey, we got a computer now. There's no reason anyone would want to play solitaire in a board game. And, you know, I still played solitaire games. I played a lot of two-player games solitaire. I still do. So I didn't really agree with that. So, and that's, I think, one of the things I'm proudest about, because I think if you know, I'm not, you know, maybe I'm being a little egotistical in saying this, but when Israeli independence came out, there really wasn't a solitaire board game market. It didn't exist at that time. Now it's a huge element of the hobby. There's, you know, I saw Beyond Solitaire. It was on here. It's a huge segment, not only in historical wargaming, but also in European gaming, Eurogame. You know, those two ideas of rebringing back the solitaire game and the linear movement was in my mind. Now, let's get to the proximate cause. I decided I'm Jewish and I'm very active in my synagogue. So I decided that I'd teach a religious school. And so as we're teaching fourth, fifth, sixth graders, religious school. And I said, you know, one thing that could be very educational are games. I'm very into games. But of course, most of the games I play would not translate well to fourth, fifth and sixth graders. And so one day, you know, I wanted to teach a class on Zionism, on the creation of Israel. It was less controversial perhaps then than today. And so I got together a, you know, legal pad of paper about, I think there were 20 index cards. And that was Israeli independence. It was created pretty much in a day with those ideas. You know, I went around the internet coming up with events. And the kids kind of enjoyed it. We'd play it as a team. And I thought, you know, hey, maybe this has got something, you know, something in the hobby. The trick was, if you ever played Israeli independence or seen it, it's a very small footprint game. Mm-hmm. It's and I just really didn't feel like, you know, I could sell this for $50 in a box. That was not a concept. So the problem was where to market it, where to sell it. Obviously, the magazine game idea came to mind, but those publishers are very hesitant to do anything involving a card.
Yeah.
And cards were critically part of that design in the States of Siege system. And so then we get to, you know, I'm very active on ConSim World. I still am. You know, I read magazines, war game magazines. And there was a company by the name of UGG. I think it's Udo Grebe Game Design, something like that.
Yeah.
It's a European company. And they had an advertisement for a contest. And it was something like, you know, can you design a game with less than 20 counters and under 18 cards? Something like that. A strange contest. So I thought, well, I'm close. I've got five counters. So well, good there. But I've got about, you know, 20 cards. And so I submitted it to them. And they were like, you know, this really doesn't qualify for our contest. It really isn't there. But you know what? We really like this. We'd really like to do something with this. Would you be interested in that? And I thought, I was thrilled. I said, that's great. You know, I'm really not about the money. That's great. And I thought it was kind of neat, a European company publishing a game on Israel. And yeah. And so there it was. And it stayed there for a long time. At some point, they basically said, you know, we're working on this. I think it's called The Rise and Fall of the Roman Empire or something like that. It was a history of the world type game on Rome.
Yeah.
You know, if you want your rights back, don't worry about it. No problem. So simultaneously, I saw in ConSim World that Alan Emmerich, who he wasn't familiar with me, but I was familiar with him from these Los Angeles game conventions, had a new little startup company where he was offering games in little plastic baggies for about $10. I thought that would be perfect.
Yeah.
And I submitted it to Alan. So that's how it started. Now, there was an interesting inside story that I subsequently heard from Alan about how that all went down. But Alan told me he was very interested, and the rest is so to speak, history.
Yeah. So the inside story is somebody over at UGG called Alan and said, hey, you should check this out.
No, it was quite the reverse.
Yeah.
He had a partner named Vince at the time. And Vince said, you know, there's not a lot to this. It's five counters. I really don't get this game. I really don't think we should do anything with it. And to Alan's credit, Alan said, no, this is a great, this is, quote unquote, and this is his quote, lightning in a bottle.
Yeah,
this is going to be great. And he went ahead with it. We added three counters for a variant where you could have reserve offensive, so it got up to eight. My joke was always, it's the best solitaire war game on the Israeli war, the first Arab Israeli war, that can be played in under 15 minutes. And I think it still is. And then I don't know if you guys are familiar with the guy, and I sometimes mispronounce his name, but Marco Arnudo,
who's a
reviewer in Indiana.
Yep.
He posted a video about the game and how he loved it. And I think that really brought attention to it. Dave Powell, who is involved with GMT, was saying, I'm playing it on airplane trays. It's great. It's portable. And so it kind of took off. And I'm very happy about that. The moniker States of Siege does not come from me. That came from Alan. Alan came up with that once he expanded it, and he trademarked it too. So for a while, I would be very hesitant in using that term. I just say my game system. but now I think it's okay. And BBG's rights are owned by Tabletop Tycoon, so it is an existing line now.
Yeah, yeah. As you looked to, so you caught lightning in a bottle, as you said, with Israeli independence. Was there a thought as you were working on that with, hey, this is kind of cool, I can probably do some other things with this? Or did Alan come back to you and say, okay, hey, that was great, what's next? How did you go from Israeli independence to the next couple of States of Siege? I know Soviet Dawn's in there also, and yeah. And you know where that fits into the pantheon of games, but you've got some other States of Siege ones as well. How did that evolve at that point? Did you take it and turn it into a line? Was there some? Did Alan go to somebody else and go, "Hey, we've got this cool little system. Come do the Alamo. Come do Colonial North America, whatever."
Yeah, I think it's kind of both. I mean, I think I kind of thought, hey, this is kind of interesting, but it's very basic. It's a very simple game. Mm-hmm. I can take this design, and there are other scenarios that I could transport it to. So I certainly always had that concept. And when we get towards Soviet Dawn, you know, that was my dream. That'll always be my favorite, because that was the period of history I studied as an undergraduate. I had worked on a Russian Civil War game back in the 80s. It wasn't any good, but I already had that idea. But also Alan said, you know, I'm starting up a new company. This is great. Let's do something more. And so Alan certainly did. And I think there was, I won't say conflict, but there was a basic understanding that I'm a lawyer. I've got a family. I don't take game design is not my relevant share of my income. In fact, I pride myself that all my royalties either go into history books or games. It's just funny money, maybe game conventions occasionally.
Mike, that's what we needed to start doing, man. Designing games to pay for our game habits.
It goes all right, over well with the wife, you know.
I'll start looking on Amazon to see if you can buy some talent there first.
So I think Alan wanted things to expand more than I could. And in fact, you know, to this day, I've got four games to my name. You know, how many States of Siege games are there, or even, you know, or Stage of Siege related? You've probably got dozens upon dozens.
The 12th season of Mentions and Dispatches is made possible by all of our Patreon supporters who pledged at the top level. The Armchair Dragoons would like to thank Michael Sunborg, Fred and his dog, Chet Bell, Hellcat 6, Patrick Geraghty, Stagger Wing, Kevin Bertram, Mike Quigley, Martok, and Joseph Knoll for their support of the Regiment of Strategy Gaming, which helps us bring you the best strategy gaming articles, events, and this podcast. You can join us as a Patreon supporter at patreon.com/armchairdragoons.
I did design the second one, Soviet Dawn, but after that, the vast majority of them were designed by others, and we'll kind of get into that story. Soviet Dawn was you know, an interesting game design. I really loved doing it. It was really a labor of love. One of my favorite aspects of that game is I was reading a book, what's it called? Red Victory by W. Bruce Lincoln. And it said that when the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk, which is a seminal turning point in the game, was offered to Trotsky and Lenin, obviously Trotsky thought it was a horrible deal, did not want to accept it. And Mikhail Bukharin said, okay, well, let's reject it and continue to fight in the war, just relabeling World War I as a revolutionary war, a revolutionary war. So in the game, I have this turning point that when the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk card comes up, the player can decide to continue World War I or accept the treaty and end World War I. Now, I'd say about 8 or 9 times out of 10, it's better to accept the treaty because the Germans are powerful. But it gives you a little wrinkle where you have a short-term political advantage, and if you can swing victory during that time period. And so I thought that was a really neat thing that I came up with there. The other thing I did is, you know, as you know in this hobby, I won't say they're trolls, but a lot of people who critique games.
We can call them trolls. There's a few of them. There's a few of them that critique more than just games, and there's more than a few of them that just want to bitch. So
yeah, that's right. So there were a lot of people who would post on Board Game Geek, et cetera, good things about Israeli independence. There's some every once in a while who would get a political, you know, oh, it's about Israel, it's horrible, you know. But occasionally there were people who had, you know, meaningful dismantling of the game, let's just say. And I took that constructively. I said, you know, what is he saying about my game that I could not have in the next game? And he said, you know, well, the common complaint, I'm sure you've heard it, is that my games are whack-a-mole. Things just, you know, it's just random. Things pop up. You got to put it down. And when you can't put everything down, you lose. Okay. And so this guy said, you know, there's no real decision-making. You just attack the closest enemy front. Now, I think that's overstated even in Israeli independence, because there are some cards that you can force people out even if they're further back, and you might want to not attack the biggest threat. But I tried to use that to make more decision making. So then I added the political system, where you can invest the political system, the Red Army reorganization system. And the Red Army reorganization system, you know, I'll give credit where it's due. A lot of that came out of the research system in Axis and Allies. You can see the link there. Yeah. You know, I had things like sub games. You know, obviously, when we get to Autumn and Sunset, we got a sub game. But, you know, the Tsar's Fate being a sub game that, you know, you got to watch out. Doesn't matter if the Eastern Front is threatening Moscow, because if the Eastern Front kills the Tsar, liberates the Tsar, then you're screwed. And so you got to look at that, too. And driving powers out, et cetera. So I use that criticism.
So there's a question that I ask a lot of folks that have card-driven games that have events in them, just because it's a point of curiosity for me, but it's always interesting to see the variety of answers that we get on this. Mike's heard this question before. He probably already knows where I'm going here. There are some card games. Twilight Struggle is a key one like this, where essentially you have, if you go through that card deck, 98% of the events in there are things that actually already happen. And you're sort of resequencing them. Or you may choose ops versus event, and this event doesn't happen, but that's because I'm using the ops points to do something else or whatever. In the coin games, just about all of those events are events that actually happen. And so the event happens or it doesn't. But what you almost never get is an event for something that could have happened but did not. And I'm curious if there were any of those, because you mentioned the idea of let's reject the treaty and continue the fight. Are there other kinds of cards like that in any of the games that you had designed, of things that could have happened but didn't actually happen? And then sort of how does that spin forward? How do you incorporate that somehow into the game? If they're out there, what are they? And, you know, what'd you do with them?
Yeah, it's a good question. I have to give some thought on that. You know, I would say that's, you know, the Bruce Lincoln Bukharin option card was unusual in that, you know, I was just inspired. It was just an inspired moment. And actually, this gives me a lot of insight on future design in terms of creating events that didn't happen. I think the distinction would be is that card was the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk, which did happen.
Yep.
What didn't happen is it was rejected, and that created a different outcome. So it was a fork. It was an event that occurred, but it was a fork not taken with that event.
Yeah,
I, you know, because I want these games to be played in historical order, you know, everyone has the option. Like, if you buy a first edition of Israeli Independence, the numbers of the cards will be way off. But when you get to Soviet Dawn, when you get to Ottoman Sunset, when you get to Habsburg Eclipse, all the numbering of the cards are in order. They, you know, so you can play, for instance, Habsburg Eclipse, you could play it from event 1 to event 60, and that would be actually all the events that happened in the order they happened. So
I noticed that. It took me a second to catch on, but I did figure it out.
Yes. Now, that being said, I almost never play play myself the game then. I don't like doing that because I think there's something really neat about the way a shuffling and trigger cards and affecting the events does. But so putting an event that never occurred would kind of throw off the historical game. Mm-hmm. But I think the idea of a fork that you can, you know, for instance, there's a card in Soviet Dawn, fortifying Petrograd. Historically, Petrograd was threatened in the summer of 1919, and Lenin was kind of like, you know, hey, you know, we got to let it go. We cannot defend it. It's too close. The White Armies are coming in. And that was Lenin's position. Whereas Trotsky's position was, hell no, I'm the man for the job. Put me in there, I'll defend it. I think it was maybe Boris Shirlov who's defending it. Put me in, I'll defend it. And he did. And so the player, when it faced with that card, has the option that they can take two actions and do whatever they want, you know, on the board, or forfeit their two actions and fortify Petrograd. That's sort of the same kind of fork. So I prefer more kind of the fork, so I keep the historical narrative possible. But I guess when we get there, we get into one of the neat features, and I'm not sure I completely envisioned this when I started with Israeli independence. But wargaming always has had this problem of hindsight, that if you're playing an Antietam campaign game, if you were McClellan and you looked on a board and saw where the Confederate dispositions really were and the amount of the strength points, which most games you could do, you would, you know, say, let's charge in. Let's go after him right now. Destroy him. Yeah. It would be a one-sided game.
If you were McClellan, though, and you saw those numbers, you would still question. You would say, no, there's more than that. I am not advancing.
Yes, maybe. But chances are McClellan believed the board looked different. He was maybe wrong, but he believed it. And so the States of Siege has a unique idea that, you know, the parameter, you might know the history, you know what did happen, or you're learning what did happen, but it doesn't have to happen as it did. It can happen in a totally different order. And so that changes up the whole thing. Now, there's a big split in designs. For instance, my games are very random. Usually I have, you know, you have a first deck. There's a trigger card that brings a second deck in, doesn't remove any cards from the first deck. And then there's a trigger card that brings a third deck in. And so you could have something that in Soviet Dawn, you could have something that happened in, you know, 1918 happened as the first card. Something that happened in 1919 as the second card. Something that happened in 1920 as the third card. And the fourth card could be back to 1918. A lot of other States of Siege designs will have what I call seeded cards, where, you know, your first card is, this is the first card, and you shuffle everything in between, but the last card will be Pearl Harbor, or the last card will be Napoleon declares himself emperor, or something like that. And so it keeps you a little bit, you know, struck. But the Soviet Civil War, nothing was more chaotic than that. So it's, you know, anything could happen. And I like that.
Yeah.
I really like the randomness in games like that, where that you have to be careful, because like you said, there are some games that card driven games that where you will have those events like you're talking about, that you'll say start the Civil War and the first card you draw, it says, well, you know, there's riots in New York. And you're like, well, wait a minute, it's April 1861. What riots are going on in New York? But yet you get the randomness, though, you know, and I like that.
Like, I love the game Paths of Glory. I love that game. But it hit World War I is one of the periods I study. And, you know, the Schlieffen Plan was a disaster. And every premise that the Schlieffen Plan was predicated on was untrue. You know, that we could drive France out of the war right away. That the political consequences of invading Belgium won't matter. That Russia is a steamroller and there's nothing we can do about Russia. So we got to get France out. All those were proven completely 100% false. It was the other way around. And so with World War I, I always think, well, what if we did the Schlieffen Plan the other way? You know, attacked Russia first and just kept France at bay.
Yeah.
When you play Paths of Glory, your first card is Guns of August. You're committed. You're on that path, and all your forces are set up that way. And the neat thing too is, I'm not saying these are role playing games. They're not, but there's a story that's being created, and that's what really I think appeals to people, that, you know, you're gonna lose most of the time. These games are viciously hard. That's intentionally so, and I can talk about that. But you're gonna tell an interesting story that you know I lost, but the Finns took Moscow. or the worst shame, I lost an Israeli independence to Lebanon. Okay? That happens. That's a mark of shame.
Yeah, that's the bringing back the what is it, the Polish Lithuanian Commonwealth, you know. kicks the Reds around a little bit. When these conversations have come up in the past, we did ask the question about sort of what's not in Twilight Struggle, but you could add Jason Matthews actually weighed in. I was like, this is kind of cheating for you to be the guy weighing in on this, but I guess they had actually kicked around a couple of cards. One of them was Israel joining NATO, which was actually discussed some. One of them was, what if Puerto Rico had flipped and gone Marxist similar to Cuba? So these were things that didn't happen, but weren't completely implausible based on what was happening at the time when things were going on, that they could have been, you know, realistic things that could have happened in the game. You hardly ever see those kinds of things show up in the games that are looking at past historical events. And like you even mentioned, you know, the Habsburg eclipse and Ottoman sunset, like you could literally play the war in order if you wanted to, based on the numeric sequencing of the cards. I did figure it out. I don't know if it specifically says that in the new version of the rule book somewhere, but after a few minutes, like, wait a minute. These things are all numbered, I'll bet. And so I looked at it after the game. I was like, you know, I probably should have paid more attention to this to start with. But like the first thing you do is you shuffle all the cards. So you're not paying attention to the numbers on them.
Yeah, I've never encountered that. And it's really interesting now. I'm really interested in this idea that you could take, and I guess it would change the gameplay dramatically if you put those cards in historical order versus just shuffle them up and going at it. I mean, I would think it would still be a fun game, but that would be interesting. I'm trying to think of another game that does that, and I can't think of one where it gives you the option of putting, you know, your event cards in chronological order.
Yeah, well, it also is very good on a playtesting level, because if you're doing a historical game, you want to make sure that history could be repeated.
Yeah.
So by having that variant, it keeps me honest, because, you know, then I can play the game that way and make sure that, you know, if certain results occur, you could have what really did happen. Gallipoli really could open up like this, and they really retreat after this at this point, and Bulgaria joins the war at this point. It was a little frustrating with Habsburg Eclipse. Habsburg Eclipse, I had a couple frustrations in game design because it just didn't come together as easily as the others. And if you ever notice, there's a dual trigger for the third deck because I couldn't make it quite, you know, one of the things I couldn't make work was, you know, the idea that, you know, like the Bulgarians come in and then you go to the next deck, but the Romanians haven't come in.
Yeah.
And it just didn't work. So I had to do a dual trigger where you have to have both those cards come up to get you in the next epoch. And
that actually helped in one of the games I played, though. So keep one of them at bay long enough for the other one to, the, you know, finally show up.
I guess the other thing is, you know, history is so rich, and for each of these designs, some of them had in the Victory Point Games days, I did expansion sets where we had expansion cards, but there were events that had to fall on the cutting room floor, so to speak. And so just having, you know, it may sound 60 events, that's a lot for World War I, but there were so many things going on if you added something that didn't happen, not only would throw off the historical game, but it would mean that something that did happen would have to get dropped off.
There's a lot of war gamers that don't like the ahistorical stuff at all. They don't want the alternate history to come into play. I mean, some just don't like that.
Yeah,
it's just curious because they're creating an alternate history by rearranging things as it is.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's like you said, you set the dice right that first turn, you're already off the rails. That's true.
You know, if I do it, launch a coup in Bulgaria in Twilight Struggle, I've created alternate history right there.
You brought up an interesting point in terms of you should have the historical outcome, you know, should be able to fit in the game. And I don't think anybody disputes that. How, if at all, do you consider balancing the historical outcome, not just as being possible in the game, but as being sort of the most likely path in the game? And the example that I come back to in many cases here is, you know, the Battle of Cowpens in South Carolina was not a slam dunk for the Americans. Several different things had to go really right for that one to get pulled off the way it was. And there were a couple of inflection points in there that basically the Americans rolled a double six, right? You know, and so while, you know, if you're designing a game on Cowpens, do you want to bias it such that the historical result is the most likely, or do you want to look at that historical result might have actually been the outlier and might have been the lucky die roll that happened to pull off a couple of good maneuvers there? You know, how close to the center of the bell curve do you put the historical outcome as you're looking at that path?
I don't, this is probably not the answer you're expecting, but I do not consider it at all. Let me put that in basics. Basically, my goal is, number one, I have to make the historical result possible. Mm-hmm. I don't have to make it probable. I don't have to make it common. In fact, it's probably incredibly, in most war games, it's probably incredibly improbable, certainly in my games. But I have to make it possible. But my number one goal is making the game very difficult. I do not, because if the game is simple, if the game was simple and it's a solitaire game, let's say Israeli independence was a simple game, you won your first try like that.
Yeah.
No one would want to play it again. Yeah. There'd be no replay value. And so I had to make it possible to win. And you can win all my games. All games can be won. But I had to make it improbable that you win. And that is divorced from the history. Mm-hmm. History is independent of that. So when we look at Israeli independence from a simulation point of view, and I've studied a lot that these Arab Israeli war, the history of Zionism, and all that, it is totally a reverse paradigm in the game. I mean, Israel was almost predetermined to win that war. By 1948, all the cards were set up in Israel's favor. Now, the extent of their victory, obviously they lost East Jerusalem. I got that. And that's why I had to make West Jerusalem the critical point, because East Jerusalem was captured by the Jordanians. But the game plays out like this David and Goliath, and you're David and you're fighting off these Arab armies. And that's a narrative that a lot of people have proposed, but I really don't think that narrative when it comes to 1948 is true. I think there's a lot of reasons for that. I could spend hours talking about that, but but you know, that is inaccurate. If I look, I'm reading right now a book on the Russian Civil War by Anna Reid. You know, the whites really were so disorganized, so uncoordinated, and that goes well with the AI of the States of Siege game, but I don't think they could have won. I have a real hard time. The Allies really weren't committed. But the vast majority of times you play Soviet Dawn, they will win inevitably in some way, shape, or form. So there's a disconnect there, and I accept that disconnect. And it makes the player think when they win, it's a hell of an achievement. And it is. When we talk about, you know, Ottoman sunset, half for eclipse, well, those ones, you know, the historical was collapse. And so it is appropriate that happens most of the time, you know, so there you are. And it gives you sort of almost, I don't say respect for how well they did and how they managed to last 4 years in the war. But you will see in those games, the puppet master of Germany that looms. It's very interesting because people say, why don't you do one with Germany? And there are a lot of reasons I haven't yet. I've thought about it. But Germany is very much a player in Ottoman Sunset and Habsburg Eclipse. Yeah. They're just the puppet master. They're behind the scenes.
Yeah, especially Habsburg Eclipse. So I absolutely. Mike, what else you got, man? I feel like I'm dominating the conversation here. I'm trying to.
No, you're doing good.
Yeah, well, you're supposed to be co-hosting, man. Come on. I'm trying to work you into the conversation here, dude. As you were looking at the, as you're looking at how the States of Siege series kind of evolved and expanded, and other designers got their hooks into your set of mechanics, is there somebody else's States of Siege game out there that you look at and you go, "Damn, that one was really good"? Is there another one of them that's a particular favorite of yours from either just a player experience or design perspective that you really like?
Yeah. You know, well, firstly, let me admit, I haven't played them all.
There's a lot.
There's a lot.
I haven't played them all. In terms of the expansion of other people doing States of Siege, I'm incredibly flattered. That does not bother me that they got their hooks into it, as you said. I love it. I subscribed to Strategy and Tactics magazine for over 25 years. Most of those games, as you probably know, were designed by Joe Miranda. Joe Miranda has done a couple games in States of Siege and a few in the magazine that look very similar, I'd say adjacent. And I'm so flattered. I mean, that's amazing. The guy who, I've been playing his designs for years has done, and I play tested Zulu on the Ramparts, which is a totally different take. I love that he did a tactical one. The one that busts me up the most is probably the most successful is Dawn of the Zeds. I mean, I did this historical war game and it's zombies. That is the most successful game in the whole series.
You can put zombies in anything, man.
Yes.
Much wider audience with the zombies.
Yeah. I love Levy and Mass. I really respect Cruel Necessity. Those are John Welsh games. And I have a funny story. I'll go back to John Welsh. I do have a copy of We Must Tell the Emperor.
How much do you want for it?
I'm keeping it.
Yeah, it's a smart thing to do.
and it's interesting, that game, because one issue that came up very early on in the States of Siege system was there are a lot of scenarios where you could do this. But when you design a solitaire game, you're playing one side and you're playing a side, And I guess, you could say, hey, Soviet Don, you're playing the Bolsheviks. Those are pretty nasty fellas, They did some pretty horrible things. And I got that. And some people would say you're playing the Israelis, nowadays. But obviously the scenario States of Siege, when you look at World War II, or especially the end of World War II in Europe, definitely would work. So Alan came to me and said, why don't you do, World War II States of Siege? And I thought about it and I go, well, you'd be the Germans, you'd be the Nazis. And I, being a Jewish game designer, I don't want to do that. That's not, I'm not condemning anyone who does that. It's just not what I want to do. It's not what I want to play. There's a lot of solitaire games right now where, you play a German sub-commander in World War II there's a lot of other games. I can play other games. I don't have to feel like I'm role playing that side. So I guess We Must Tell the Emperor is a little bit of a guilty pleasure because somebody else designed it. I didn't have to. that also goes with, I don't remember what Hans did, a Civil War one. And I know there's Jefferson Davis's war where you're playing the Confederacy, which isn't that noble a power as things go. But I don't think I really have the chops myself to do the game on do the tactical games that have been created. I really think strategic is kind of where I'm at. So I love it. I love it. And I went to a game convention recently. It's a couple of years ago. And Blue Panther was there selling White Dog games. And there was a game Gorbachev. And I look at it, and the back of the box says, "R. Ben Madison says I want to thank Darren Leveloff for his wonderful game design." Buy this. It's got my name on it. I do like that game. I do really like that game. So there's a lot. The funny story about Levy and Mass is, I'm active in the game conventions in Northern California. And at one PacificCon some years ago, we'd throw lectures, and Victory Point Games was a exhibitor there. And they threw one about States of Siege system, and I talked. And there was this school teacher from the Sacramento area, and he seemed very interested. He was asking me questions about it, and his name was John, and I told him stuff. So then Alan writes to me, and Alan says, I got this email from this Australian high school teacher, and he says he'd really like you to create a game on the the Revolutionary France. And I said to Alan, I said, yeah, well, that's interesting. I don't know that I really have a lot of knowledge of that. That's probably not my field. Within several days of that conversation, John Welsh turns in Levy and Mass. So it's like, oh, wow. Well, there it is.
One of my first encounters with the States of Siege system was Joe Miranda's Empires in America. And as you've noted, like, you know, these things should be hard. The first time I played the game, I got my ass kicked, which I think is probably by design. But there was one of the gameplays I had, second or third one, where literally everything broke perfect for the French. And pretty much North America is now unified under the banner of French Canada, you know, based in Montreal, and the entire eastern seaboard of America is speaking French and eating escargot as our national dish. I mean, it went that perfectly for the French. It was really weird. It just somehow everything broke right in the other direction. And I don't know that, you know, that game, I think all of the tracks are five space tracks. I'm not sure anybody really made it past the third space at any point in time. And I don't know that I ever had two people even on the third space simultaneously. It was just one of those games that everything landed just perfect for you. I was like, you know, that was fun, but that's got to be pretty highly improbable.
Yeah, that's so rare.
Well, yeah, and a lot of people, you know, will say this, the States of Siege are just, you know, it's just luck oriented. It's just luck oriented, just rolling dice, you know, and all that. And I think, yeah, there is that aspect. And if you roll superbly well, you will win automatically. And if you roll superbly bad, you will lose automatically. But the real game is, what can you do to maximize your odds? What can you do to increase the odds? You know, on Soviet Dawn, you know, when do you roll for, you know, Red Army reorganization? You know, when, you know, if you get this, what do you choose to do with your actions? You know, it's all about that. And your odds may be in your favor and you lose, and the odds may be against you. But if you play the odds, just like any game, Vegas, you know, it will increase your winning. And so, you know, there's a friend of mine, David Kennedy. He's active on Board Game Geek. He's analyzed like complete odds of things coming up. And, you know, I think he has the odds of winning Soviet Dawn at about 21% or 19%, somewhere like that. So, you know, the odds of certain cards coming up. And, you know, that's what it really is, a game about, you know, you can't do everything, but what can you do that's going to be the best decision to make and create the best situation for you?
Yeah.
I think that's why, you know, you said earlier, you know, people criticize these types of games as being whack-a-mole. And I don't think that's fair, because there's just so much more going on. If you actually sit down and play these games, you know, and you're dealing with, if the game's designed properly, you've got limited resources for one thing. And then you have like only so many actions you can take per turn. And so you have to choose, you know, you have to make decisions about where you're going to spend those resources and what you're going to do. And then, yeah, then you have, you know, the luck of the die roll. And that's not something that's just restricted to States of Siege games. That's any war game. When you're rolling dice, you're at the mercy of the dice. I don't care what you're playing. That's like Brant just said, you could roll all ones or you could roll all sixes. That's just part of the game.
Yeah. I have some funny stories of, I don't know if you guys have ever played Lamps Are Going Out.
I have yet to play it.
So it was being demoed by the what are they called? The War Game Boot Camp my local convention. And I just kind of stepped in as the Western Allies, and I decided to attack in Belgium. And I just had these series of rolls that were incredible. My opponent had a series of rolls that were horrible. And I ended up winning as the Allies in the winter of 1915, World War I.
Wow.
I went all the way to Berlin on one offensive. You know, so these things happen. I got Grognard of the year for doing that. but, you know, I also try to, you know, I've also tried to put games within the games. With Soviet Dawn, you have the political track, which is sort of a game within the game. The Tsar and his fate, which is sort of a game within the game, the Red Army reorganization. But when you get to like Ottoman sunset, you have when the British tried to force the Narrows with their fleet. That's a game within the game. And so, you know, you could be doing great on the board, and then all of a sudden the British fleet, you know, just wins because you haven't fortified enough. There's nationalities management in Habsburg Eclipse, which is a game within the game. So that's another way to do things. But yeah, I agree. luck is part of the game, and it's part of the narrative. And you know, some things are fun. In Soviet Dawn, I have a political dissent role that you can modify, but when the anarchist comes out, Nestor Manco, you can't modify it. You have to, you know, just whatever happens, happens.
It is what it is. Soviet Dawn has been republished by Worthington.
Yes.
And Ottoman Sunset and Habsburg Eclipse have been republished by Tabletop Tycoon's Victory Point subsidiary, but it's Tabletop Tycoon. And I will say, look, this is not a knock on Alan, and I'm sure he would admit the same thing. The production values are stellar for Ottoman Sunset, Habsburg Eclipse, and I've seen Soviet Dawn. They look gorgeous. Certainly a big step up from what the original Victory Point Games packages were, but that wasn't what Alan was trying to do, so it's sort of an unfair comparison. That said, Israeli Independence hasn't been republished. Is there, notwithstanding the current political climate, because I don't want to go down that rabbit hole, but has there been any approach to it? Has there been any interest in it? Or is it one you're just trying to kind of keep to yourself, and it was a thing of its time, and I'm happy, and let's not mess with it?
And no. If so, would it be a deluxe version or a changed version?
Okay.
In any way?
Yeah. So that's a good question. And Mike, that's a question I've asked myself, because I do conceive of it coming back. Okay. I definitely, it's become a collector's item. It's kind of funny. And I do conceive of it. The problem is the same problem it originally had. It's a small footprint, very basic game. I think it uses 24 cards, because the reason is it originally used 22 cards. But Alan said, hey, we print cards in 12s. And I added two cards. I went back and added two cards.
See, that was the sign to put an event that didn't happen but could have.
Maybe I could have. But there's still a lot I left on the cutting room floor.
So. Oh, I know.
So I don't think, you know, Soviet Dawn is you know, I won't say it's a big game, but it deserves that kind of treatment. The mounted map, the gloss cards, same thing with Ottoman, and you can play Ottoman and Habsburg together. You know, if you put Israeli Independence in with a mounted map, you know, eight glorious counters, maybe make them this big, you know, huge, and sold it for $50, I would feel bad. So then the thought, and it gets sort of to Mike's question, well, what do I want to, there's only two options I can do there to give you value added for the product. And one is, okay, that's the basic game. Let's make the advanced game. And so I've toyed with that. You certainly, the less you abstract in that conflict, the more of a political minefield you encounter, because that even today in the current situation with Israel, what happened in 1948 is discussed almost daily. It is part of the dialogue. That was tricky. You know, I was excited when GMT has the British Way and they had a game on it, but it seems like that simulates not the Arab-Israeli war, but more the British and Israeli militants, which is a sort of different look. So I've thought about that. I've toyed with that. I haven't reached a game design on this, as I'll say. So the second option is, okay, well, let's bundle it with another game.
Yeah.
And so the question is, well, if I'm going to bundle with another game, it should be thematically related. I shouldn't, you know, it shouldn't be the fall of Rome thrown in there. that wouldn't, you know, wouldn't be quite right. So the question is what to do there. I have an idea, and I have done some preliminary work on it, but, you know, I'm not the most efficient guy in game design, and it hasn't been done yet. And I'm hesitant to bring up what it is, because I've discovered a lot, especially when you take a system that has certain variables, you'll find, like, I was thinking of doing a game on the Alamo. Well, hey, Alan, hey, we got an Alamo game. It's already out.
Yeah,
I love that little game, but it's not mine. You know, I also had sort of a mega opus idea of going back to the biblical period. Where I could use like sayings of the prophets from the Torah and all that in there. You know, maybe, but maybe that's a little ambitious or won't work so well with the States of Siege system. But so yeah, I am thinking about it. you know, I'd also like to do something new and, you know, not just re-release games, but come up with new games. But, you know, Alan had a great saying, his triad, as he called it, I think, that there are three things. There are living real life, number one. Number two, playing games. Number three, designing games. And you can only do two. And so I've been doing, you know, playing games and living real life for a while. And that's kind of cut in on the game design.
Yeah, a fourth leg on that stool is writing and podcasting and reviewing different things with games, and you can still only do two. So
yeah.
You know, I have managed, I don't do podcasting obviously, but you know, I have done some articles, both about my games or just historical articles, in wargame related publications. So I'm happy about that. I did a military history of Jerusalem article for Against the Odds magazine, and that was really nice. And
sort of unintentionally, Mike, did you have another something you wanted to go in here?
No, I think he covered it.
You sort of unintentionally started to drift into where I was going to go as we start to wrap this up as kind of a last question, which was, what's next? You know, is there something on the drawing board that is close to imminent? Sounds like probably not, but are there some blue sky ideas out there? Not necessarily what you might be wanting to bundle Israeli independence with, but you know, if you didn't have to spend so much time living real life and you were just playing and designing, like, what, you know, is there something that's just out of view on the camera, that's up on the wall, taped up with a bunch of sticky notes, that's the design in progress? What are you working on?
I have more ideas than games. I have designed some games that have failed, or just stalled. I have been helping a fellow who did a States of Siege type game on the Civil War campaign for Atlanta.
Okay.
And so I'm helping him kind of develop it. So I'm hoping, I think I could get some interest if I could get it into shape. I play tested it at a convention last September and felt that there were still some things that need to be worked out. So maybe that'll be the next thing I do. I've given a lot of thought about a solitaire game on World War II, where you're the Allies, not necessarily using States of Siege. It probably would have some elements of it, but be very different. And I have some ideas for that. I have an off the wall idea for a multiplayer States of Siege involving a political issue. I'm not going to leave it at that. You know, I toyed with a game on the July crisis in World War I, but now I've noted that Worthington has a Maurice Suckling game coming out with that same theme. So, you know, I might.
Hey, look, there's three major releases on iLOW that are all dropping within like 4.5 months of each other. So
I have
not think that this somehow crowds you out of a particular space.
Yeah, no.
I have no game on iLOW in development. But the Bulge now.
Yeah, exactly.
Actually, Joe Miranda did a Bastogne game for World at War magazine that got States of Siege elements into it. So
there was a Twitter thread that was started by Sebastian from Georgetown talking about, you know, so what are some conflicts that people don't have that there aren't games on that you would like to see? And it was funny because a lot of the suggestions just proved how few people bothered to use Google, because they were things for which there were multiple games. But then some folks started busting out some fairly obscure ones, and you were able to point them to, no, there's actually a game or a scenario within this game system where you can find these things. What I found hilarious was somebody had mentioned the Great Emu War, the big emu hunt down in Australia shortly after World War I. So people had brought emus there as like livestock birds, basically, but enough of them escaped and got out, and they were overbreeding in the wild. They were starting to mess with, you know, crowd out some native species and whatever. So they rearmed a whole bunch of Australian World War I vets and sent them on this big emu hunt. So it's not really an emu war. It's sort of, you know, it's the buffalo hunt from the, you know, the 1800s on the U.S. Great Plains. There's to go kill all the emus. There's like four games on the Great Emu War. I mean, So the fact that something weird and obscure like that can have multiple games published on it, I would not rule out anything that somebody else is doing. You're fine.
Fair enough. Fair enough. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. But as you said, Worthington re-released Soviet Dawn. It's great. I love the box. The box is my favorite thing because it's got this great picture of Lenin on the cover. But if you take the cover off, it's got this whole scene of Lenin and with loads of people on the inside cover.
Yeah.
Period photographs and standees. I like that additional thing for that version. The Tabletop Tycoon version is great, and they map together very well. There were a couple small production issues, but the big one is they missed some strategic sites, but they've released a corrected patch that you can put a sticker on top and correct that. Then on Habsburg Eclipse, they do say the Great War 1914 to 1916, whereas a lot of games will end in 1916, but
I was going to say there's your alternate history,
if you're bad enough at it.
But it doesn't affect gameplay at all. So that's all good. And they've done some wonderful, basically painted art, like almost cartoon art, that really is very wonderful in a different take. So I really enjoyed that version. And I play these games myself. That's a great thing about being a solitaire game designer. It's easy to play test, and it's easy to bring them out yourself.
Well, I would think you'd want to design a game that you'd want to play. So.
Yes.
I mean, that's how a lot of designers start, right? The game I want to play doesn't exist, therefore I have to design it.
Yeah. Well, and then nobody can say, I beat you in your own game, because
yeah,
that can't happen if it's solitaire. So
unless you're me,
Butterfield beat me royally, and I was just in Portugal. I met the game designer of a game called Trench, and he clobbered me twice. It's a chess variant. So
yeah,
there you go.
Well, cool. Mike, you got any final questions you want to throw at our guest here?
You touched on, I guess, Brandon asked the game design question. I assume you're still constantly thinking about maybe more ideas. So you had this States of Siege idea. Are you collecting other potential solitaire game ideas that aren't the standard, tracks coming into a central area? Maybe just a totally different take on solitaire design.
Yes. Yes, because that World War II idea has sort of a new idea involved in it, and obviously I'd like to see if it works first, but yes, I'm a fan of these games. When I think we live in an era where there's been so much innovation, and you talk about Twilight Struggle, the coin games, I mean, there's just the whole card-driven thing. It's just revolutionized, our hobby. Every day I play a new game, and I go, wow, that's kind of neat. I picked up the game Banish the Snakes. Probably not a topic that normally would interest me, but there's some neat things in there that from a solitaire perspective could be used in other games. You've got this great palette to work with, and then you've got to appreciate the designers of old who didn't have a great palette to work with.
Yeah.
I think the card-driven motif allows you to offload a lot of rules complexity out of the rule book and onto the cards, right? Every exception is on a card somewhere, but it's on the card. You just follow the instructions on the card and off you go.
Yeah, like Empire of the Sun. Wasn't that just so easy to sit down and play?
But imagine how much worse it would be if you didn't have the cards to do it and you had some table of random events you were rolling against,
Yes, I got it.
That would be even more painful. Well, cool. Hey, we're a little over an hour as we are recording this. Probably by the time I finish editing out my verbal gaffes, we'll get it down close to an hour. But I don't want to infringe on your time too much more here. So I do appreciate you being here. So thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us. And who knows, maybe one of these days you'll drop that stash of 15 extra copies of Israeli Independence that you've got back there, and finance a vacation out of Mike buying a bunch of them on the resale market there.
Well, thank you for having me. I really enjoyed this, and thank you for everything you do for the hobby. And hopefully one day I'll go to one of those conventions on the in the Midwest or East Coast and run into you.
Come over to Origins. Yeah, Origins is sort of our anchor convention where we do a lot of the wargaming stuff. But Buckeye Game Fest is a great smaller sort of low stress kind of play focused game convention that's great. And also, as you would guess, right there in Columbus. But you know, there's all kinds of stuff. One of these days, who knows? One of us may make it out to one of those West Coast conventions. You know.
Yeah, I've been to Origins a couple times in the early 2000s, and I think we've talked about it. And I felt that at that point in time, wargaming was being given a little bit of more of a short shrift, and it's probably not true anymore today. But
wargaming hasn't often been Gamma's highest priority. Let's try and be polite about it. but they also lacked people really pushing for it until we kind of kicked the door in about 10 years ago and said, we need more of this. What can we do? Basically, sort of, what can we get away with? Is kind of what we asked. And now that we've got the oil spot in the driveway, it just keeps expanding. And so we're trying to enlarge that wargaming presence as much as we can, just a little more every year and keep it going. So wargamers are never going to be, 60-70% of the convention the way they were back in the 70s. That's just not going to happen.
Right.
But can we be more than 4% of the convention? Yes. Yes, we can.
Very good.
We can hit a double digit percentage of the convention. I'm convinced we can get there. Audience, thank you very much for joining us for this conversation. We're starting to wind down the season. We've still got at least one more visit with the practitioners from the professional wargaming world will be joining us. We are going to have our look ahead to the summer convention season that will be coming up. At some point, we're going to pin Gary down to talk to us about the CSRs. And Mike keeps threatening to do a Mike and Bob show, and I keep waiting for it to show up one of these days. So we'll see what happens with that one. In the meantime, Darren, thank you for taking the time to join us. Mike, thank you for, coming off the road to join us. I know you're a little wiped out. But appreciate you being here. And we'll catch everybody next time on another episode of Mentioned in Dispatches.
Thank you, everyone.